right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And today we're going to explore two different questions that are actually very closely related, although they may not seem that way at first, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Emily and Elizabeth Hinkler, the actors in a two-woman play that I saw recently in Los Angeles, and the play was called My Sister. It's an extraordinary and powerful play written by Janet Schlapkohl, and it tells the story of Germany in 1933 as the Nazis consolidate power and everybody had to make a moral choice to resist or cooperate with the horrors that are beginning to unfold. I thought this is a conversation that people everywhere need to hear and need to hear it today. And opening the show up, we're going to be talking about the FBI versus Apple with two guests from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF, which has been fighting the government's attempt to consolidate their right to spy on everything and everybody, including you. And it's also the story of the people who are not going along with that and are standing up to fight it. First, we're going to hear from Shahid Buttar, the director of grassroots advocacy at the Electronic Frontiers Foundation and a constitutional lawyer. Then we'll be talking with David Green, senior staff attorney and civil liberties director at EFF, who has just filed an amicus brief in the Apple versus FBI case on behalf of 46 technology experts. All right, so let's start with Shahid Buttar. Shahid, you are a constitutional lawyer. You're the grassroots and student outreach director at EFF, and you've been paying a lot of attention to what's been going on between the FBI and Apple. What do you think people have to know about? What's the basic fact in this case?
What the FBI is demanding courts do is undermine the user security of hundreds of millions of people around the world using essentially a set of pretexts before the court that are not entirely true. This case is not about one phone. This is not about one investigation. This is about the security of the internet and all of us. And those are the facts that the FBI's presentation of the issue has tended to obscure.
Mm-hmm. So basically, though, now the one thing that keeps coming up, and I, you know, for me, it's sort of like, I'm not really all that knowledgeable about electronics or about any of this stuff. So I'm thinking, essentially, I have a phone, and as long as it has buttons to push, I'm perfectly happy with it, right? But as long as those buttons aren't fake and I can't reach anybody, I'll be all right. But the point of it being, this whole thing has come up, that the FBI essentially wants to create a backdoor to people's private phones. What exactly is that, and what would that mean in practice?
You know, trying to be as precise as I can in the case before the court, what the Bureau has demanded is that Apple engineer new code, a new version of the operating system that drives this version of the iPhone, to then disable certain core security features so that the FBI can then hack it. That's sort of what's at stake. And one way you might describe it is sort of, you know, removing the security gate to enable the Bureau to then hack the phone. But by doing that, in this case, what it would create is a legal precedent not only available to the United States, but potentially by creating code that does not now exist, creating power that could be claimed, whether by hackers, whether through a legal process, by authoritarian regimes around the world, by black hat hacking syndicates, by narco traffickers, by random criminal gangs. You know, when you talked about the buttons you press on your phone, the reason that the company started putting them on there was because people's phones were getting swiped on trains, you know, walking down the street, and every time somebody takes your phone, what they have in their hand without these kinds of protections that Apple is trying to defend for all of us, without those kinds of protections, what somebody gets when they get your phone, if the FBI has its way, is potentially, you know, the intimate images of your partner that you might text back and forth, your entire financial history and transaction history, right? Depending on how you use your phone, all your communications through multiple channels with everyone you know, your work contacts, your business contacts, your intimate contacts, your long-distant friends, your family. These are privacy issues as well as security issues that no one's talking about in the context of a particular case. And just yesterday we filed a brief, an amicus brief, one of several, that hopefully will inform the judge, who, to be frank, apparently, you know, at least when first issuing her order, apparently didn't understand much about the technology either, to inform the judge about the broader issues at stake and hopefully to achieve a more defensible result.
Mm-hmm. Now, you wrote a piece, you wrote a number of pieces on this, and the first one that I read was Apple, Americans, and Security versus the FBI. And in that, you argue that this is beyond just one phone. Is that what you're referring to in the last thing you were saying?
There's several ways to look at that. And there's no question this is beyond a phone. In fact, the FBI has admitted as much. In a congressional hearing earlier this week, the FBI director, Comey, was pressed in response to questions by members of Congress, and he admitted that this case would set a precedent. Similarly, prosecutors around the country have already come forward since I wrote that article saying that they have indeed hundreds of phones that they would like to use the same software on if Apple is required to create it. And these are not cases that are national security cases. These are garden variety crimes. So the question becomes, do we want to undermine the security of an entire device platform and create a legal precedent that could compel countries to hack their users when the government demands for the sake of, you know, Cyrus Vance, this prosecutor in New York, who's using this controversy as a pretext for a power grab? That's what's at stake here.
I read something earlier in the week. Someone was writing about this, and they said that they made the point that actually, if the FBI was really going after just one phone, even if they were going after this phone, that there was a lot of moves that were made that actually indicated that there was something bigger going on, including one where they did something where they basically
locked the iCloud.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are potentially reasonable explanations for why the Bureau might have done that. They thought there was another attacker out there, but at the end of the day, you might describe this as a challenged investigation because the Bureau did the wrong thing out of the outset. And by locking the phone and closing that pathway, and let's be clear here, this is the work phone of someone who had personal phones and destroyed them. And this was a work phone belonging to a county agency for which this person worked. The idea that this phone has information useful to the investigation has not been proven. But that aside, because I don't think that's the important point to focus on here, the important point to focus on here is that the Bureau is demanding powers to fix an investigation that went off the rails at some point. And at the end of the day, what is at stake in that claim is reaches much further beyond this investigation. That's the biggest issue before the court that the magistrate, quite frankly, didn't even necessarily have a chance to consider before. Right, the order that became very controversial that's prompting the subsequent judicial process when Apple filed its brief this week and we and others filed ours just yesterday, that controversy was driven by an ex parte hearing, which means the government appeared before a magistrate judge, demanded certain things. The magistrate approved those demands without ever hearing from Apple. So nobody had a chance to explain to the magistrate that, Judge, the FBI is lying to you just like they lie to Congress. And that's not even my words. There's a member of Congress who said that on NPR yesterday. The Bureau, in case after case of this sort, misrepresents the facts. And I don't want to say disingenuously. I mean, I'm sure there are very well-intentioned people there. But at the end of the day, this case is more about the FBI's power versus national security and security for all of us than it actually is about a serious investigation of a very unfortunate, tragic accident being used in a very even more tragic and unfortunate way.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this, because I read, too, that Apple has cooperated with the FBI 71 times in the past. What makes this time so different? It's clear that they're actually saying, look, this is where you draw a line. This is something we can't go into. We can't go beyond what we've done, and this we're not going to do this. What makes it so different than the 71 times they cooperated in the past?
Well, Apple's still cooperating. I mean, Apple's provided resources to the government. They have an entire team trying to support it. What's different now is that the code doesn't exist. Apple created security at the device layer to protect users that it itself could not crack. And the reason for that is it relates to a whole series of incidents when phones were being taken that were then being cracked. This was supposed to be unbreakable security. What's different now is that the government is demanding that Apple create new code that would undermine the security of code that it already created specifically to give its users, you and I, dissidents around the world, journalists, human rights activists in repressive regimes, LGBTQ people in countries where they might be greeted with very hostile receptions by other people. This was a matter of security for those we people. And what's different now is that for the first time, the FBI is saying, okay, you have to not only help us crack this phone, but you have to undermine the core security protocols for an entire operating system. Here's the key, too. We haven't talked about this, but it's worth making very clear for your listeners. Apple has said from the very outset the reason they don't want to create this code is because no one could keep it safe. This code would be among the most potentially lucrative hacks in the history of the Internet, right? And we should be very clear here. Nothing is safe online at the moment because of, well, for a whole range of things. And just as a matter of example, an astounding number of people don't realize this. Last year, for 6 months, Chinese intelligence agencies were hacking the Office of Personnel Management in the federal government, and they got the home addresses, the work histories, all kinds of information, including very sensitive information, about 22 million federal employees, including CIA agents. And for what it's worth, myself, I was being vetted to be a diplomat in the State Department nearly 20 years ago. All of that information the Chinese government has, if the Chinese intelligence agencies can hack the federal government for 6 months to get the home addresses of CIA employees, what makes anyone think, especially when Apple is saying we can't keep this code safe, what makes anyone think that creating the very dangerous code that the FBI is demanding in this case could be relegated and kept to safe purposes? This is an incredibly dangerous demand that the Bureau is making, and I do hope very much that as the judge evaluates the broader interests in the case, the values at stake, as this controversy ultimately moves to Congress, where I hope Congress puts an end to this power grab and makes very clear that encryption keeps us safe and is available to all of us. We hope very much that the judge reverses the order and that we remain in a world where companies can engineer security protocols for their customers' use without being required to undermine them.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Shahid Buttar. And Shahid is from the Electronic Frontiers Foundation, and we're talking about the Apple versus the FBI case. Now, Shahid, your own work has shown that there is actually a vast U.S. government spy apparatus. Because when you're thinking about all the things that come into play, yeah, if the Congress does this, if this, but there's still this like forever grinding along in the background. There is this huge network of U.S. spying that's going on their own people beyond what's happening internationally, you know. Really, I often feel like there's not much you can do. You can't even watch TV without thinking someone is knowing what I'm watching, you know? So it's a very heavy thing when you think about this in terms of what this spying apparatus is and what difference it makes to them to have the kind of freedom that they would have or have the kind of advantage they would have if Apple was forced to do this.
I absolutely agree, and I would just maybe flip one of the words you used. You were describing, on the one hand, the spying to which we are all increasingly subject, whether using the phone, whether using the internet, increasingly if you drive your car that has electronic components and is communicating with some satellite, the Internet of Things, you know, the wired refrigerator that orders milk when you run low, those become vectors of potential surveillance and monitoring. And you use the word freedom when you describe the government's powers. And I tend to think of the government's powers as about authority and the limits on the government's powers as about freedom for the rest of us. Mm-hmm. And these cases, these controversies, these issues about what can intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies demand at whim, disregarding the Fourth Amendment privacy interests and the First Amendment dissent and journalism interests at stake. When we think about whether or not the government should have these powers, I think it's absolutely necessary for us to recognize the freedom that we give up when we extend those powers. And this case is no different than any of the others over the last several years in which we have unfortunately lost freedom as the government has gained power to use potentially arbitrarily. And the last thing I'd say, when you bring up the domestic spying apparatus, which of course includes the NSA and a number of other agencies, it proves the point that the agencies do not tell the truth when appearing in public fora. I didn't actually uncover anything. The person who uncovered particularly the domestic spying apparatus is in exile because he can't get a fair trial in the United States. Mm-hmm. And what Edward Snowden showed was that the Director of National Intelligence, the senior most intelligence official in the domestic and foreign intelligence network of the United States, lied to Congress when asked a direct question with advance written notice. This was 3 years ago now. Congress hasn't fixed those problems. Now we're looking at the FBI director who's, you know, playing loose with the facts in a court and trying to, you know, be, to use the NSA director's words, too cute by half before Congress, and it really takes a hard look at the implications of their statements. And here's the biggest issue: a meaningful investigation into the issues that the officials are not being truthful about, right? Congress has rested for 40 years on oversight hearings where they invite people in suits to come and tell them things. But since 1976, no one has meaningfully investigated the intelligence agencies. And the last time anyone did, what they found was what the U.S. Senate, this is a quote from Book 3 of the Church Committee, described as a sophisticated vigilante operation aimed squarely at, end quote, various constitutional rights. That's what the agencies have done for years and years and years. That's what's at stake here in the Apple versus FBI controversy, both the erosion of core constitutional rights, investing credibility in agencies that have repeatedly shown themselves not to deserve it, and most importantly, I think, in this context, undermining security for all of us. Mm-hmm. That's what the FBI is trying to do here.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you one more question, and this is something that you wrote. I can't remember what it was in relation to, but it really struck me. Oftentimes, when these kinds of moves are made, there's the hearkening back to, I mean, if you think back at 9/11, you know, you think back what happened then and how so many rights were just sort of like gone. The national security letters, the fact if you went into a library, the book that you were reading would get reported to the FBI or to whoever. All these things are always tied up with this. They're always tied up with some perceived threat or some incident that happened that then's worked out as like, it could be worse next time. We've got to take a move around this. And unleashes all kinds of horror. You mentioned too, and I thought this was very heavy. You said that oftentimes as a civil liberties lawyer, when you're talking to people about this situation, that oftentimes you get this, and I know I've heard it myself, if I have nothing to hide, then I have nothing to fear. And I'd like you to respond to that, the response that you make to that, because it's extremely important in terms of people thinking about what's at stake and what they should do.
Yeah, I agree, and thanks for raising the question. You know, when you don't have anything to hide, what you have to fear is other people silencing themselves because they might feel they have something to hide. And so another way to think about that is that when anyone has something to hide or something to fear, it silences our democracy. And we should be clear here that the targets of domestic surveillance, and quite frankly, what the Senate again described as dirty tricks far worse than surveillance, like plots to drive people to suicide, were people we now applaud as national heroes. There is a national holiday named after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was the prolific target of a long-running FBI documented in paper plot undermining, and here's the point, not just his rights, but the rights of millions of people who he was defending and trying to advocate for, and through that process, harming the rest of us too, because of course the rights that were extended in the civil rights reforms weren't just for some people, they were for Americans, right? All of us suffer if anyone in our democracy self-censors. That's the theory of the First Amendment. That's what it means to live in a free country. And so when we sing anthems at baseball games, what we are saying is, I will not give up my freedom merely because I have something to hide, because my freedom rests in my neighbor's freedom too, right? You can't have freedom for some. Freedom is a shared value. And when we trade it, we lose it for ourselves, even if we think it's only other people being impacted. That's the key that we have to grip here. An image that a colleague of mine shared recently that I found really illuminating here is that whether it's security or freedom, when you pull the plug, it's like being in a boat with a plug in the bottom. And when you pull the plug, you can't isolate where the water goes, right? We lose security and we lose freedom. And the point is we lose it together. You can't isolate.
Okay. All right. Shahid Bukhtar from the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us on. Your listeners can learn more at EFF.org.
All right. Thanks a lot, man. Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Shahid Bukhtar, Director of Grassroots Advocacy at the Electronic Frontiers Foundation and a constitutional lawyer. Continuing our conversation about the Apple versus the FBI case, we're going to be talking with David Green. David is the Civil Liberties Director for the Electronic Frontiers Foundation, and he's the lawyer who filed the amicus brief in this case of the FBI versus Apple. And that amicus brief was signed by the EFF and 46 technology experts, including security researchers and cryptographers, as well as digital signature pioneers Martin Hellman and Ronald Rivest. David, welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here.
Great. Well, this is a hell of a case, man, and we've been exploring one aspect of it just in terms of, you know, some of the stuff of what it is and what's the social impact of this. And I wanted to talk to you because you were one of the attorneys that filed the amicus brief in this case, and I wanted to ask you some questions about that. And one is, actually, what exactly is it that the court has ordered Apple to do?
Well, what they've ordered Apple to do is to assist the FBI in brute forcing the telephone. And by brute force, we mean bombard the phone with various password guesses so that they can get access to it. Right now, the phone has at least two types of protections on it that make that difficult. One is a protection that if with 10 incorrect guesses, the phone is wiped clean. And the second one is that actually the more you guess, the slower it slows down your ability to guess, which usually people are trying to brute force phones. They actually do it mechanically. So this makes that very difficult because it won't accept the passphrases, the attempts as quickly as the machine is spitting them out. So it's primarily those two protections that the FBI has asked Apple to override.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've read a lot of places where it's talked about as though the FBI is actually demanding that they create what amounts to an all-new version of its operating system with intentionally weakened security features, which is what you're talking about. But this would involve an all-new version of its operating system?
It would require those features, and there's a few others as well, but those are the two main ones, are part of iOS, of that version of iOS. So in order to modify that for this phone, they actually would have to edit iOS in a way and rewrite it in a way that doesn't exist right now.
Is this court order, the temporary one that came down, and what the FBI is trying to get the courts to do, I've read that this is considered unprecedented. How so?
Well, there's never been, as far as we know, and the FBI hasn't cited any examples, there hasn't been a situation where a company has been ordered to create something that doesn't exist in order to assist the FBI in the way that this does. The previous examples are the FBI asking a phone company to place a trap and trace device so that it keeps track of calls being made, to place that on the phone line. It's things like that, but it's never something where we're actually asking them to create a product or modify an existing product in a way that just doesn't exist. And so that, even if you would take out all the other issues, that level of assistance and sort of conscription of a private company and private individuals into government service is really unprecedented under this legal authority.
I was going to ask you about that, about it being unprecedented, because it seems actually, I mean, look, there's a thing I'd like to get a little bit more of an understanding around. When the FBI comes in and says that they actually want to force Apple to basically disregard all the security that Apple has put up there for whoever's using their phone, if the court rules on this, it's basically saying that there's really no protections that anybody can have in terms of keeping their own phone calls and who knows what else private.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's hard to see what the limiting principle would be. If the FBI gets this authority, it's difficult to see, well, what can't they have a court order somebody to do in order to help them with an investigation. And again, you really have to think about this beyond this specific investigation, because when you talk about these cases in terms of their precedential value, they're establishing that the FBI has this power, or that the law the FBI is using, the All Writs Act, actually authorizes this level of technical assistance, then it's hard to see what is the end point of that. If the FBI wanted, and then when you think about the Internet of Things and to the extent to which you have items in your house collecting data about you, the information you store on the cloud, and all these things that you take precautions to protect that information, it's really hard to see that if they can get the authority to do this, where that will stop.
You know, David, I have to tell you, it's a very serious point, although I have to tell you, as soon as you said the thing about all the things in your house that's keeping watch on you, I was like, whoa, wait a minute. You mean, what the hell? I'm not going home tonight.
Well, some of these are things we do have convenience, right? So some people are very fond of the thermostats and your security devices that basically keep track of people coming and going.
Mm-hmm.
And the more devices you connect, right, and this information is stored in the cloud, it sends them a ton of information about what you do in your home that's available to somebody.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. You know, I just saw Werner Herzog has a new film coming out, and I was up at Sundance and saw that up there. And it was really very heavy, because he was very concerned about what would the impact be if the Internet could run wild. You know,
it was a very
disturbing vision of what could actually happen. You don't realize how much you're sacrificing in relation to the way you plug your house into this whole big network. And there's a hell of a lot that's at stake there.
Well, I think what's important about this case is that even if you want to do that and you choose to do it and you're savvy and you also want to protect your privacy and you read everybody's privacy policies and you take all these steps, what this case says is that the government can still conscript a private company into helping it get around all of those protections.
Right. We'll probably get into that in a couple minutes more. But I wanted to ask you this. You mentioned the All Writs Act. That's been referred to a lot since this case first came up. What exactly is the All Writs Act?
Yeah, the All Writs Act was actually passed in 1789 as part of the original Judiciary Act. And it basically just gives courts the ability to craft orders that make it necessary in order to fulfill their other duties. So it's sort of an all-purpose type of, back then in 1789, what the federal judiciary could do is actually not that well established. And so what it did was basically give the federal judiciary the ability to make orders that would be consistent with its other duties. That's what it did. The fact that it's old, it doesn't matter because, you know, there's lots of things that are old that we love. But what's interesting about it being so old is that in all those years, it really has never been applied to the way that it's the FBI is asking in this case.
Is that what Apple meant when they said that this is an extraordinary expansion of the All Writs Act?
I believe, well, you'd have to ask them what they meant, but I think that's a fair statement if they were referring to this. I don't know of another situation where a company's been asked to actually affirmatively create a technology that doesn't exist.
Yeah, it's very heavy. Put it this way, if this goes through, what's your assessment of the overall impact of the court order against Apple?
It would be a few things. One is that if Apple is forced to make the modifications to iOS, then that's going to be a modification that's now going to exist, that's going to threaten the security of all iOS, at least all iOS 9 devices. So that's one thing, right, that there now is going to be a way to defeat those technologies, and Apple can do the best it can to sort of keep that safe, but it's still going to be a vulnerability that's going to exist. The second thing is that once the FBI gets this authority once, it's going to seek it again, and they've even said as much that this isn't an isolated case. And so I think we'll see other requests for similar authority in other cases, and right now it might be modifying iOS, or next thing it might be doing something else, creating another product to assist them. We also know that on the local law enforcement level, that local law enforcement is chomping at the bit to have this authority as well. And so we will then see what happens there. You know, Cyrus Vance, the New York Attorney General, has said they have 150 phones they'd love assistance like this getting into. I believe Charlotte, North Carolina, the DA there is talking about 70-some phones that they want similar authority. You know, so I think you're going to see this happening all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the amicus brief, you have argued that this is a violation of the First Amendment and free speech rights.
Yeah.
Explain that, because a lot of people don't think of a corporation as having actually free speech rights and the First Amendment protection.
Right. It's a few things. I think there's we did choose to address that. You know, with amicus briefs, you know, friend of the court briefs, what you typically do is to choose one point that you think that you can most assist the court in making. And we did believe that both for ourselves and for the 46 technologists, researchers, and cryptographers who we represented in this case, that we could be most helpful in explaining to the court why its order was a First Amendment violation. So there's a few things to understand there. One is that it is an order against Apple, but it's also requiring Apple's programmers, the ones who have to do the work, right? So now that corporations have free speech rights, you might disagree with that, but it's something that's actually well established in the law now, and that's not just from Citizens United. That dates back many, many years before that.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you don't believe that, you know, this is actually going to require, you know, individuals to be the ones who are speaking. The second thing to understand is that the courts have also established that computer code is speech. It may be in a language that some people don't understand, but foreign languages and actually even languages that very few people understand are still considered to be speech protected by the First Amendment. The specific aspect of the First Amendment that's being violated here is the prohibition, and I use that word in quotation marks because it's not a strict prohibition, on what we call compelled speech, the idea that the government cannot force people to speak, you know, except in very, very, very exceptional circumstances. And we believe that the court order that requires the Apple to create code, to speak in computer language, and then perhaps even more importantly, in order for that code to work, even if they created it and would give it to the FBI, or even if the FBI would create it on its own, it won't work unless Apple verifies it and authenticates it so that the phone trusts this new code. That process is known as a digital signature process, and it's saying this is good, this is authentic, this is something that's safe to use.
Mm-hmm.
that is speech. It may be speech taking the form of code, but it's an assurance, it's an endorsement. It's all types of things that are communicative. It expresses beliefs and assurances, and that is speech. And they are forcing Apple to that, even though Apple doesn't believe it to be true.
Mm-hmm. When you step back and you look at the impact of this, I've read in a couple of places where people are saying that this actually puts the security and privacy of many millions of people at risk. What do you see when you step back and you want to leave people with some kind of sense of like, look, this is fairly serious. This is very serious. Because a lot of people might look at it and say, oh, come on, how does this concern me? Even with everything that you've been saying, the people don't tend to see that there's a major social impact of this that actually fits into a very dangerous things shaping up in a society in terms of the ability to go after people for whatever went, like you were saying in the beginning. But this culturally, there's a whole way that this fits in with a lot of the, you know, xenophobic stuff against people, especially people from the Middle East that they're going after. What do you think about this in terms of the social impact of this?
Yeah, it's I think it's actually really hard to assess for the same reason I said before, is that there's no limiting principle to the government's position here, and the number of situations you could see this being applied to, again, is unlimited as well. I think the original message the government had when this first came out was just about one phone, and they've wisely gone away from that. But it's important to understand it's not just about one phone in two ways. One is that, again, in order to help the government to break this one phone, they have to undermine the security of the entire operating system. That's one thing. That's going to affect everybody now. And then the second thing is the presidential value, is that you're just establishing the idea that this is something that this law can't even possibly authorize.
Mm-hmm. And generally in society, you're thinking, you know, look, a lot of the ways that they actually, there are these like beginning moves that actually eventually people get very sort of like used to them. They get sort of inured to these outrageous things that are being done, and they sort of just allow it to happen, which is could be some part of this whole situation in terms of the outcome of it all.
Well, I do think so, and I think that's a lot of, if you read the government's arguments, a lot of it is really trying to convince people that this is just something that's not that bad, that the government always has a right to people's evidence, which is sort of true, and trying to, I think, make this not seem quite as extreme as it is. And I said, you know, the government does have a right to people's evidence, but the law actually recognizes, you know, many exceptions to that. And some things are actually quite commonplace. Your attorney cannot be compelled to turn over, you know, information that you've communicated to your attorney, right? You know, that's an attorney-client privilege. Spouses can't be compelled to testify against each other. Doctors can't be compelled to testify against their patients. I mean, there's all sorts of things that we've made the societal judgment that people don't have to turn over information.
Right, exactly. All right, David Green, thank you very much for joining us today.
Sure, happy to help.
All right, we're going to take a quick musical break, and we will be right back.
Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany, just before the war. A meanness swept the land, stealing our hearts and the hands of time, taking us back in history to a place on the darker side, where we saluted the flags of fear and the voice of ignorance roared. Taking us back to Germany just before the war.
All right, that was Germany just before the war. All right, that's a great song. It's a piece that I've been playing for many years, but I had forgotten about it for the last couple of years, and it really fits with the whole theme of today's show, and especially with what's coming up now. Joining us now are Emily and Elizabeth Hinkler, the actors in My Sister, a two-woman play at the Odyssey Theater, as I said. And this is an extraordinary and powerful play. And it was written by Janet Schlopkohl,
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, I got that. There you go. And it's a very powerful play, okay? And it tells the story of Germany in 1933 as the Nazis were consolidating their power, and everyone had to make a moral choice to resist or cooperate with the horrors that were beginning to unfold. Emily, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
And Elizabeth.
Pardon me?
Oh, for both of us. Thanks for having both of us.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just... See, now you have to talk right into your mic, okay?
Okay.
All right. Elizabeth? I'm not going to let her get away with that. She can't say, oh, yeah, thanks for Elizabeth, too, okay? Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks.
Hi, sure. Okay, you guys can do whatever you do normally. And I should tell people that one of the parts of the play is that it's about identical twins, okay? And it just so happens that the actors who are playing the identical twins are themselves identical twins, okay? And I know that I'm expecting that at any moment to sort of I'll turn around and they'll switch where they're sitting and stuff, and I won't be able to find them. But we'll still be able to carry out the conversation because they're both very good at what they do.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. I saw the play, and I was just stunned. And really, I was sitting there, and I was like, this is like, you know, it was quiet at the end of it. The one I saw, it was quiet. I guess it was your opening night, maybe, or maybe, no, it was afterwards. It was after that. But it was very, very quiet. And I looked, and people were just like pushed back in their seats and were like, whoa, what the hell just happened? You know? And it's that powerful. It's that powerful. And I want you to tell people what the play is about. And either one of you, raise your hand and I'll pick with you. Right? Okay, Emily, go ahead.
Our play, My Sister, written by Janet Schlopkohl, directed by Ron Saucy and Paul David Story, is about two twin sisters. I play Magda, a hospital floor mopper by day, an aspiring cabaret performer by night. And Elizabeth? And my character is Matilda, who is a writer, but she is also homebound and lives with cerebral palsy.
Now, tell me something. How did you decide who got what part?
Well,
this is just out of my curiosity.
Oh, okay. Yeah. When we were younger, we were also dancers. And when I, Elizabeth, was dancing, I tore my ACL. And I was homebound and couldn't really move around our house for about 4 months. So Emily carried me around the house and really took on the caretaker position. From that experience, that's basically how we decided who gets what part.
Wow, you carried her around the house?
Yeah, I mean, she had crutches, but our house was very narrow, so she couldn't even, like, crutch through the hallway or anything, or in our bathroom or anything, so I just had to carry her.
Did you live in a maze?
Yes.
Okay. All right, that explains everything. All right, well, I want people to get a sense of the play from the very beginning of the show, and so you were going to do just a selection from the play, and I want people to... listen to this and get a sense of the power of this play, because like I said, it's something that it just touches so deep on so many levels. So let's just jump into it and you guys can introduce it, tell them what it's about. So,
okay, so the context of where we are for this scene is it's about over halfway through the play, and Magda has just come home from working a night at the cabaret. And she says that she has an opportunity from being and working at the cabaret that a director might come in and see her for an opportunity to work in a film. And my character, Matilda, is suspicious of what this film is about. Okay, mm-hmm. So. And just a side note that Matilda's character, she does have cerebral palsy, but also her speech is affected, so you'll hear that.
Yeah, so you'll be able to tell our characters apart.
Okay.
Is this a propaganda film?
It's just a movie. It's an opportunity.
Don't you know who is producing it? Is it Goebbels?
I don't know. Is this about the Galvegs? You know, I like the Galvegs.
A Life Not Worth Living. You know that movie?
We don't go to movies.
I read reviews and film magazines. Triumph of the Will. Do you know that one? Rats, Jews, and imbeciles destroy Germany.
Why are you so angry with me? What's wrong with you?
What do you see wrong with me?
Nothing. You are feeling sorry for yourself. Mama wouldn't tolerate it, and I won't either.
Eat your Kuchen. What's wrong with your sister? Did you get tired of hearing that?
There are so many things that make me tired.
Why can't you just go along with this until things settle down? What does that mean? Just because they voted in that idiot as chancellor doesn't mean anything. Nazis are powerless without a majority. They can't succeed with their uber-conservative ideas here. In Berlin, people must realize that.
Until the cabarets are closing. The cabaret Schlechter El Dorado is now Nazi headquarters. You haven't read about that, but I saw them taking down the sign. People get the wrong idea when you make comedy of things.
You already said that.
I don't mean we can't be funny. Just cut some things out and add other things
in. Don't tell me what to write.
You tell me how to act, and it is me alone on stage facing the audience.
You don't see things.
I see things all the time. I see people getting beaten up, dragged off. Maybe I should stop and ask for details about their politics. Things are getting out of control. This is not the old Berlin.
The old Berlin. You're echoing propaganda. Can't you hear yourself? Can't you see where that is headed?
You can see where everything is headed. That's good. I'll be fine with you because you have all the answers.
I need you to know what I mean. I need you to understand.
Why are you being so dramatic?
You frighten me.
Afraid of me. Of me, I am a scrubbing mopper, a disinfecting nobody.
What am I? A useless eater? Do you want me to go back home?
What are you talking about?
Get Herr Holtz to carry me down the stairs. Put me on a train.
Things are happening for us. I am doing my best. And now I'm going to be late.
I can't not be political.
Fine, I'll perform whatever you write for me and be fired. Or at least taken in for questioning. And if I'm lucky, I'll remain at the hospital cleaning piss off the floors forever.
Like you do here.
It is different.
Yes, this is familiar piss. This is the piss you know.
Okay, so that's our scene.
How do you come out of that? I mean, I'm watching you cry, and I'm like, what the hell? You can't come out of that. It's like, okay, that's our scene. I'm just teasing. I'm just okay. Teasing because it was that powerful. It was, again, it was very powerful.
Thank you.
It brought me right back there. And it really brings up, one of the things that got me in relation to the play was that it operates on so many different levels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the sister relationship. There's the sister differences between them, the love that's actually there, but then also these very intense differences, which you were just speaking to in this piece that you did. And it also has to do with, you know, how they see the world in a lot of ways. You know, I'd like to talk about that a little bit in terms of how you see that in terms of the characters themselves. This idea of how people actually see the world, how they see the world around them and how they respond to it. Because there's some very interesting things, like your character, Emily, is out in the world, mm-hmm. even if it's just scrubbing the excrement off of the floors or whatever in the hospitals or taking care of people. And Elizabeth, your character, whose best friend is a shortwave radio and spends all of your time in the house and can hear, you can't see, but you can hear what's brewing in the streets outside. And really a remarkable, relationship going on there. But there's these differences. There's the similarities between the two sisters and the differences, which are really critical in terms of how they view the world. So let's talk about that a little.
Yeah. We had a talk back a few weeks ago, and we had the pleasure of actually having our playwright, Janet, come to one of the talkbacks. So we were so fortunate to have her. And something that she brought up, which was really interesting, because one audience member asked, well, they're identical twins. So how do they get to be so different? If Matilda did not have cerebral palsy, do you think she would be an actress and a cabaret performer? And Janet said to that note, I mean, people, their interests kind of arise based off of what they're exposed to. So for Matilda's case, because she stays inside all the time and she has nothing, I mean, she creates this world of her own. I mean, she has a small spoon that she pretends is her sister when she's alone, and she has a cup that she pretends is her mom when staying inside. And besides writing, she listens to her illegal shortwave radio. And I mean, that is where she gets all of her information. But the question arises, if she was not in that situation and if she was out in the street just as Magda is, working and trying to make a living for both people, would
would that actually be the case? Would she be paying attention to the world and what is going on?
And I'll just speak to Magda's point of view. For Magda, it's essentially the story of everyone at that time who wasn't being targeted, who didn't have a disability, or who was quote unquote the I'm blanking out right now, but who was like the
mainstream.
The mainstream people. And Magda, you see her point of view, which Janet masterfully wrote. She has to do all she can to take care of her and her sister. She has to pay all the bills, get all of the food, not only care for some patients at the hospital, but care for her sister. And you just see her trying to survive. And at the audience, they question, oh my gosh, would I be paying attention to the world? And Matilda's character always tells Magda, she says, pay attention, pay attention. But if you're walking down the street, like how Magda does, and there's someone getting beaten up or dragged off, like how we just did in the scene, I just said that, there's a point where you need to survive. And so the audience questions, well, who would I really be like in this play? Who would, what would I do? Mm-hmm. What would be my situation? So I think Janet presents both points of view instead of going like, oh, I would be better than that. But you see both points of view.
Well, you know, to me, it kind of looks at, and I was thinking about this a lot last night, it's sort of, it's yes, but no, because there's the differences between the two of you, mm-hmm. between the two characters. There's these differences. But the differences also are expressed in how each character views the moral question that's posed to a certain extent, and the morality is decided on the basis of what's acceptable to you, what's not. You know, that's what it is, right? And so like with Magda, there's a whole scene, I can't remember exactly what it was, but where she starts mimicking or repeating some of the slurs and some of the lies and the disgusting dehumanization that mm-hmm. she hears day in and day out in the streets, at work, all these other places. And also repeats the lies that have been told to her, which she believes, that when people are taken out of the hospital, they're being taken to the nice, you know, sort of the equivalent of, they're going to the farm where they'll be treated nicely and they'll get treatment and they'll live happily ever after.
Right.
And Magda tends to buy that. And with your character, Elizabeth, it's very heavy, because your character actually, while she is just in that room and doesn't even go out of the room, she actually makes an analysis of some things, and she's putting some things together. And that's what that clash you had here in this piece is mm-hmm. so damn important, because it speaks to the question that basically that Janet posed about, a big part of this is about dehumanization and what will you tolerate? How much of that will you allow it to happen? You know, right. And it's not, like, so go ahead, let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, I mean, especially for Matilda, what my struggle is why I am a writer and why I write the cabaret acts is, I mean, not just to pursue our dream, but it's for people to understand what is going on. That is my political outlet. That is where I can tell people what is going on. Yes, it's through humor. Yes, it's through jokes. I have so many jokes that I tell. And I mean, I'm very humorous, but also it's poignant in the same way. And Magda is her outlet of getting across her
right.
work and her political acts. There's a moment in the play where I am alone in our apartment and I am sharing what I just wrote as my act. And then Magda is in the cabaret world and she starts performing her act, but it's changed. It's not my words anymore. It's not my lines. And it almost doesn't make sense, but it's soft. It's so disheartening to want to share something with the world and not being able to because of my situation and my circumstances. No matter how hard I push and I try, I won't reveal the end of the play, but just the struggle of really trying to express what I need to an audience is so crucial to my character and so heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. And if I veer anywhere within 5 inches of revealing the end of the play, I want you both to jump on me and pummel me, okay?
Okay.
You know, it's true what both of you were saying. It's true. On the other hand, there is, you know, like you your character, Elizabeth, your character comes out and, yes, you write these things, but you're driven to write them and you're not going to stop writing them.
Right.
And your character, Emily, Magda, who's really, look, Magda has, she, you know, it's one of those things. It's like, you know, I don't know if you ever saw the Nasty Girl movie. Did you ever see that?
I don't believe
okay,
so.
Okay, it's about a, you look scared when I said this. Don't worry. Nasty Girl, what the hell is he talking about now? No, it's about this young woman who goes back to her parents' town in Germany, in Bavaria, I guess. And she discovers that there were like tons of Nazi supporters in that area. She was so sympathetic towards the Nazis that it was often thought that there had to be thousands of Gestapo agents in that area because they had so many people arrested and so much going on. And it actually was because the people in the area cooperated. Most of those people were not, they don't think of themselves as bad people, but they did think of themselves as, I got to do something to survive. And so your character is always compromising to a certain degree. And you have a great way, your face, when you make those compromising moves, when you're playing in the cabaret, it's really good. Because I don't know if you're aware of doing it, but it's really good because it's sort of like you're like, oh, damn, man, I got it. She wrote me another song, but there's this Nazi out there. Am I going to really sing this, you know? And there's a way that it builds and builds and builds until you know, a certain point, you're on that track. The same as Elizabeth, you're on the other track. And you're not about to give up what you're doing either. So it's really heavy, you know, in terms of when you think about what does it take for you to either go one way or the other, you know? So.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't mean to have it be total silence. You were supposed to go, yeah, that's right.
That's right, that's right. No, I certainly agree. What Janet did that I absolutely love about Matilda is that she never backs down. I mean, and that's why the play almost gets to dangerous heights. Even just our arguments. I mean, they're very taxing, and we do get pretty tired after doing the show each night. But it's because Matilda does not relent. She does not give up. And that is such an admirable quality that to me, if I think about myself and my journey, I don't know if I could do the same. That comes from such a strength and a will. And one of my lines that I have when I'm reading a poem is, just now we have this small space before the end. We must flow against the current. And I think that is so important, especially to today and in the political situations that we're having, to be able to do what we believe is accepting to other human beings. We had a young woman come to the show. Her name was also Emily, and she had cerebral palsy. And her mom told us that when she was in class, I think it was a year ago, that she went home in tears, and she said, if I was born in this time, I would have been killed. And it stopped her. I love this play because it is so important for understanding life and human beings and supporting other people. Well, and another key aspect of this play is, yes, it is about identical twins. And something that most people don't know is, well, twins have the exact same DNA and the same genetic makeup. And Magda and Matilda, like, technically there is nothing, quote-unquote, wrong with Matilda, who has cerebral palsy. There is nothing wrong with her.
There's nothing genetically
different. Yeah, genetically different. Wrong. And so there is no reason to be worried about her at all in this time period. And so it makes people see her for who she really is instead of just judging her. But I think that is very important, especially to this time that we're in right now. And people, we just need to see each other as human beings. And I mean, I could just say so much, but.
Well, you're free to. You're free to. You can go ahead. No, whatever you want to do.
I mean, yeah, I think but just seeing people for who they really are, not judging them and the label. To add to that, one of our amazing co-directors, Paul David Story, he said one time that we get to learn about our characters, and especially Matilda, about what we love about her first before we see her as a label or someone with a disability. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that is crucial to how we also want to treat other people.
And the important part about this play, too, is we see her how her sister sees her, which is just like anyone else. And that's some of the magic of this play, but how it should be mm-hmm. every day.
This whole idea of not just knowing what you'll go along with, what it would take to make you go along with a horror, but there's also something that what's it take to make you stand up against it. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty heavy because it's really generally people have a lot easier time going along, especially if it's their neighbors are all doing it or there's something at stake. And that's what I like about the thing between the two sisters. Magda is going out and doing everything she can to actually help her sister survive as well and recognizing the danger that exists, even if she doesn't know that it's like, oh, the Nazis are taking the people from the hospitals and killing them or something. She doesn't know about the ovens and the rest of this stuff, but which hadn't started functioning at that point yet. But, you know, she does know that there's something very horrible going on. And somewhere in the back of her mind, there's something very horrible going on. And this is, you know, something that people need to think about. You know, what does it take to turn her from not just going along, but to going against it? And the same thing, you know, with your character, Elizabeth, it's sort of with Matilda, it's there's actually is this, I was really struck by the fact that Matilda, for as much as she really is a very solid person. And I was so glad that, you know, we didn't have the discussion today about the cerebral palsy and that mm-hmm. was going to sort of the defining character because there was so much more.
Thank you.
There was so much more that was there. And I thought that was really remarkable in terms of just what you were just saying about this. So say one more thing really quick. What's your takeaway? When you look at this play, what are you going to take with you when this run is over?
I think, well, for me at least, I know how are my dreams going to, what is the most important thing? When I wake up, what am I going to focus on? Are my dreams going to cloud what's going on in the world or my humanity? What do I need to do every day? Am I going to pay attention? Am I going to pay attention to what my heart desires or to what the people around me require? Like, you need to decide what is the most important thing for you, and you need to pay attention. You can't ignore certain aspects of your life. You need to see everything as a whole and not be selfish and not be clouded. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
I also think that ties into actually researching what's going on. As my character Matilda does her homework, she does her research, and to me, education has become so important to me of really knowing what the world is and who I am in the world and where I stand, and to be proud of that, to me, is very important, and I think that's my takeaway.
Mm-hmm. All right, folks, and that was Emily and Elizabeth Hinkler, and they are the actors in the play My Sister at the Odyssey Theater. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Shahid Buttar and David Green from the Electronic Frontiers Foundation, Emily Hinkler and Elizabeth Hinkler from the play My Sister. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Alex Brenner, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And keeping with today's theme, we're going to go out with a little bit more from Sonny Meadows' piece, Germany Before the War. Talk to you again next week.
A meanness swept the land, stealing our hearts and the hands of time, taking us back in history to a place on the darker side, where we saluted the flags of fear and the voice of ignorance roared. Taking us back to Germany just before